Welcome to this Forthright Radio for May 10th, 2017. I'm Joy LeClaire. This morning, we are pleased to be featuring another excellent documentary, which will be screening at the upcoming Mendocino Film Festival, Tribal Justice. Two judges, two tribes, one goal, restoring justice. And we are pleased to have with us for the full hour writer, producer, and director Anne Makepeace, and Chief Yurok Tribal Judge Abby Abinanti, who is one of the judges featured in Tribal Justice. Anne Makepeace has been a writer, producer, and director of award-winning independent films for more than three decades. Her new film, Tribal Justice, premiered at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival just this past February 2017. Her previous documentary, We Still Live Here, Us Nutayunyan, about the return of the Wampanoag language, had its broadcast premiere on the PBS series Independent Lens in 2011. Other recent films by Anne Makepeace include I Am Pei, Building China Modern, and her Emmy-nominated feature documentary, Rain in a Dry Land, which chronicled the journey and resettlement of two Somali Bantu refugee families from Africa through their first 2 years in America. She won a National Primetime Emmy for her American Masters PBS documentary, Robert Capa in Love and War. Coming to light, her documentary about Edward S. Curtis was shortlisted for an Academy Award in 2000. Her many awards are far too numerous to mention here, so we'll just welcome her to Forthright Radio. Thank you for joining us today, Anne Makepeace.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. And as I said, also joining us is Abby Abinanti, Yurok Chief Judge, who is an enrolled Yurok tribal member. She holds a Doctor of Jurisprudence from the University of New Mexico School of Law, and she was the first California tribal woman to be admitted to the State Bar of California. She was a state judicial officer for the San Francisco Superior Court for over 17 years, assigned to the Unified Family Court. She retired from the Superior Court in 2011, and in 2014 was reappointed as a part-time commissioner for San Francisco, assigned to dependency, and duty judge for that court, where she served until 2015. She has been a Yurok Tribal Court judge since 1997 and was appointed Chief Tribal Court Judge in 2007, a position which she held in conjunction with her Superior Court assignment until 2015. Judge Abinanti, we are honored to welcome you to Forthright Radio.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to join you. I appreciate it.
Anne Makepeace, let's begin with you. Every film has an origin story. As I mentioned in the introduction, you did an award-winning film on the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. And I might add that you donated the $3,000 Mountain Film Prize it won directly to the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project, enabling them to launch their first ever language immersion camp for children. But now you have written, directed, and produced Tribal Justice. What inspired you to do this film about the Yurok and Kachan tribal justice courts? Why this movie and why these tribes?
Well, as you say, every film has a unique origin. Sometimes it's an article in the New York Times or somebody I meet, or they come in all different ways. In the case of Tribal Justice, Ruth Cowan, who became the executive producer, is the person who came to me with the idea back in, at the end of 2012, I guess. And she had produced a documentary about post-apartheid courts in South Africa and was traveling around with that film and met another person who became very important for the documentary, Jennifer Walter, who at that time was, and Abby can correct me if I'm not getting her title correct, but I believe she was lead counsel to an organization called the Tribal Court State Court Forum. And Jenny had actually suggested to Ruth that a screening of the South Africa film that that Ruth look into making a documentary about the tribal courts in California. And so Ruth did some research and got very excited about the idea. And Ruth and I both live on the East Coast. So Ruth started doing some research about, you know, filmmakers who might want to take this on. She's a producer, but she's not really a filmmaker. And she, because of we still live here and various contacts that I've had working in Native American communities over the years, my name came up. And so she contacted me and came up to where I live in the Berkshires in northwestern Connecticut. And she was very excited about it and asked if I would be interested in finding out about the subject and possibly making the documentary. Well, my first reaction was, I don't really know much about tribal courts. But then on reflection, not knowing about the subject has never stopped me, because one of the things I really love about documentary filmmaking is that you enter into worlds you had no idea about, and you meet people you'd never meet any other way. So I was intrigued, and again, I am very interested in Native American cultures. And so I said to Ruth, well, if you can pay our expenses to go out to California, I would love to meet some tribal judges. So that's what happened. In February of 2013, Ruth and I flew out, and Jennifer Walter had suggested both Abby and Claudette as being compelling and interesting and important judges in the tribal courts in California. One of the reasons that I thought would be a good reason for choosing them is that they are the chief judges in the two largest tribes in California, and also their geography is so different that visually for film, it's really hard when you're switching back and forth in stories to orient audiences as to where you are. But in the film, you always know if you're at Yurok because there's a green river and redwoods and ocean. But when you're down south with the Quetzal tribe, you're in desert. That tribe's reservation borders on Mexico and Arizona. So these things intrigued me. But what I also said to Ruth was, well, you know, I don't really make films about an issue. You know, I don't make polemics. I don't make infomercials. I make films about people who are heroic in some way, who are struggling to do something, coming up against obstacles, and who have stories and who are going to be compelling over the course of 90 minutes to audiences who, you know, like me at the beginning, don't know anything about the issue. As well as, of course, reaching Native American audiences and ideally inspiring people to get involved with tribal courts and go to law school, etc. So that all said, we went out, and we fortunately were able to meet first Claudette, who was holding a meeting of people from all over her area to discuss how tribal and state courts could work better together. So we met Claudette, and I was immediately very moved by her passion for her work, her smarts, her soulfulness, her dedication. And I thought, okay, she'd be great. And then we flew up to San Francisco and we met Abby. And then once I met Abby, I was completely hooked, because Abby is so fierce and dedicated and smart and beautiful and compelling. And so it was just, from then on, it was a no-brainer. So then I sank deep into the research, and also the part I like least, the fundraising. And that's how it all began.
Judge Abby, may I call you Judge Abby?
Oh, yes, please.
Well, I asked that because in the movie, that's how some of the Yurok tribal members referred to you affectionately, very affectionately. As I mentioned in the introduction, you have worked in the state judicial system. And early on in tribal justice, you tell us that you were the first tribal woman to enter the state bar in California, and that you faced many problems, including being told by a judge from the bench, you can't be a lawyer, you're an Indian. So I think you're uniquely positioned to inform us both here today on Forthright Radio and through the movie about what it's like to have been the first tribal woman to be in the bar, but also to compare how the two justice systems work. And I found it really fascinating, the movie, the way you do that. Would you please begin, though, by sharing some of your early experiences as a young attorney entering what sounds like hostile territory?
Well, I think, you know, pretty early on, you have to figure out how you're going to conduct yourself when other people are rude. And that's essentially what we're talking about. And many people had grown used to having sort of excluding people from the judicial system, and they thought that was the norm. And I didn't think it was the norm, nor did I think it was the ideal of this particular system to do that. The pressure was, I felt, was pretty uniquely on me to conduct myself in a fashion that would allow us to continue to participate and to increase our participation. Because I think failure to participate really causes injustice. And that's what I was the most interested in. Everybody who knows me, I think, could probably say, and not unfairly, that I do have somewhat of a temper, but it's sort of like you've got to make choices here. And that's not okay. You know, you need to be standing at the end of the day and you need to do the best you can for your clients. It's not about, as a lawyer, it's really not about you anymore.
Could you tell us what year you entered the bar, just to give us some idea?
1974.
As we have learned in our history, just being a woman would have made that very difficult in the early 1970s. But being a woman and a tribal person, I can only say I'm so glad you've persevered. Back to the other question of the two justice systems are very different, the state justice system and the tribal justice system. And one of the many values in this movie is that we get to see some of those differences. Would you share with our listeners, Judge Abbey, from your perspective, what those differences are?
I think the most significant one that I can really see is that it, as a state court judge, you're really trained to, and you must be separate. You know, if somebody appeared in front of me that I knew, I really couldn't be their judge, unless it was somebody I knew in passing or whatever. In a tribal situation, we are essentially, in our tribe in particular, village people. So everybody knew everyone else. So that either meant that we went to strangers when we had trouble or disputes, or we never had any disputes. And I'm going with door number two. Door number one. We had disputes, and how did we resolve them? In a village situation, you have to meet and you have to come to a resolution. And it's all with known people. It's not justice by strangers. It's justice within a fairly known, confined system. Those values create different practices, and that's what we're really doing, is we're creating those different practices, and we've evolved. All cultures evolve, and so what practices would have been in practice 200 years ago would have evolved if they'd been continued. Because of the invasion, they weren't continued. Now we're taking them up again. You know, and we're trying to go, okay, what practices are consistent with those village values of knowing everyone and having to come to a place where, look, we need to have harmony in this community. We can't be at each other's throats. We need to go forward in a positive way. Who wants to be miserable in their own home?
And make peace. Back to you. I guess I'll address most of the Kachan questions to you. As you mentioned, the other judge that's featured in the film is Claudette White. She's the chief judge of the Ketchin Tribal Court at the Fort, is it the Fort Yuma Reservation? Is that correct?
That's one of the names. I've seen it written as the Fort Yuma Indian Reservation or as the Quetzal Reservation. Abby might know which is more correct.
No, I've always referred to it as Quetzal.
Abby's known Claudette a lot longer than I have, so she may want to answer some of your questions about that tribe, but go ahead and shoot.
At the very beginning of the segment featuring Claudette White, she points out that the Kachan have never been removed from their lands. Their lands have been vastly diminished, but they've never been removed. It sort of opens with her taking her son, Zion, to school. And then she goes to work at the tribal court. And she says that a lot of the tribal courts in California are in their infancy stages. And they're kind of like making up how things work as they go along. Their segment begins with Child Protective Services and interacting, the tribe interacting with the state over the very difficult, both contemporary and historically, of children being removed from their homes. Mm-hmm. Would you please talk about that just a bit?
So, and Abby, I'm sure, has things to say about this too, but the history of Native American children being removed from their homes goes back a long, long time. I think it became official Bureau of Indian Affairs policy in something like the 1890s, and it continued through the 1960s, where Native American children were forcibly taken from their families and put in these institutions, these boarding schools, in many cases far away from home. Their hair was cut, their clothes were burned. They were forbidden from speaking their native tongue. They were punished for speaking their native tongue and for doing anything to do with their culture. And this continued, as I say, into the 1960s, and it created this intergenerational trauma and separation from culture that I think tribes are still trying to recover from. And so that's kind of the history. Now, those schools pretty much faded out in the 60s, although there's still some, but they're not that oppressive institutions that they were back then, at least as far as I know. But the history of Indian kids being taken from their homes has continued in a different way, in which, you know, Native American kids are three times as likely to be taken and put in non-Indian foster homes than other American kids. In the boarding school era, this was a concerted effort, a conscious effort to erase, to eradicate the connection of young people with their tribal communities and their cultures in an attempt to force assimilation. Now, I think it's a little different now with foster care and, you know, kids being taken away, but one thing that has been helpful was the passage in 1978 of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which does give tribes jurisdiction over the placement of Indian children. They still have to prove that the families they're placing them with are able to take care of the kids, but they have more leeway in, for example, placing kids whose parents can't take care of them for one reason or another, placing them with relatives on the reservation so they're still in their own communities. And in an early scene in the film, a very short scene, you see Claudette with a 14-year-old boy who has been placed in state care with his aunt and uncle who want to be his guardians. And that's a very classic case of a tribal judge, in this case Claudette, ruling that this boy, Ryan, should live with his aunt and uncle and that they should be his legal guardians. So Abby, I know, has, you know, some personal experience with this, so.
Right. I think that, you know, Anne pretty well outlined what the issues were with the forced removal of children to education, and it's kind of grown into the excesses of foster care and those situations. I think the one thing in the North that played another large factor was the whole indentured slave movement, which concentrated on capturing children and then creating indentured servants throughout the state with those kids. Now, when you have those kinds of intrusions into a culture, you create horrible trauma in the culture of that time that then carries over. But in particular, something like parenting. Parenting is essentially a skill that most people learn by being parented to some extent. And if you're not parented, then when you have children, it's very hard to parent. So that if you grew up in an institution or you grew up as a slave, then you're really not going to have a lot of those skills, or you're going to have to try to learn them on the fly. And that becomes very difficult. A lot of that is when people are talking about historical trauma. That's what's being played out you know, and then you couple that with all the pressures of poverty, and you get sort of a fatal or at least a unpleasant cocktail, shall we say.
Let's focus a little bit more about that transgenerational trauma. In addition to the slavery issue that you're talking about, there was the genocide. I remind listeners of the show we did last October with UCLA professor Benjamin Madley, who documented this for the first time as extensively as it has been documented. Of course, this isn't news to you, Judge Abbey, because your people lived it. But for many people, there was out-and-out denial that this even happened, not to mention the orchestration of it by both the California state government, the Mexican territorial government, and the United States federal government. And there was the forced removal of people from their land. And the, as you said, the trauma of that, it goes beyond, I think, just parenting. I wonder if you care to comment on that.
Well, I think, you know, you get into a situation where a lot of, like, say, the indentured slaves and a lot of the massacres and the offering a bounty for dead Indians that you then could get confirmed through the courts or through the legislature, it doesn't make you feel a part of a community. It makes you feel like you're outside the community in the main, you know, and I think it plays out. I remember as a child, I don't recall how often I went to school, but I hardly went at all. And I would be home. It wouldn't be like I was wandering around doing anything, but I wasn't forced to go to school. And when there were issues that would arise at school, my mother in particular didn't know how to handle those issues, so she would just let me stay home. And it wasn't until I had sort of gone off that I learned that she and both of her sisters had been to boarding school, and they had horrible ideas of what that was and did not care for it and would not speak of it and did not speak of it. You know, and I think you go, okay, well, wait a second, you know, that impacts in my ability to go to school, to want to go to school. And then I grow up, I have a child, and halfway through her first year of kindergarten, I'm traveling, and I always take her with me. And I went, wait a minute, what are you doing? You know, she needs to be in school. And I had to, like, force myself to stop it, get a day job that allowed me to stop traveling and make sure she was in school, because my whole pattern or whatever was to not, you know, you didn't really have to go to school. So I didn't in particular, but I think that you've got to relearn some of those things. And if you look at our go to school rate, if you will, our truancy rate, it's sky high. It's the highest of any group in the state. You know, and I think a lot of that then plays out. And without an education, you're at a real disadvantage now. That's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, having heard that, my admiration, which was already really tremendous for you, just went up another several notches. In both segments of the Ketchin and the Yurok, quote-unquote substance abuse was really pervasive as one of the problems. And it seems to me likely that what we've just been speaking of, the transgenerational trauma, is both the cause of substance abuse and also the effect of it. Anne Makepeace, why don't you begin this discussion speaking of the Ketchin situation? And then, Abby, please feel free to jump in to talk about the experience among the Yurok.
Well, I think you're probably referring to the story of Isaac in the film. Isaac was 17 when we first started filming. He is Judge Claudette White's nephew, and his story was kind of a classic story of a kid being taken away and put in state care. His mother, who probably was affected by, I'm guessing, by intergenerational trauma, is an alcoholic and was addicted to drugs and lost her, you know, care of him. He was taken away from her. and put in state homes from age about 10 to 16. And when we meet him, he's 17. He's come back to the reservation, and Judge Claudette White has just taken him into her home. And she's trying with all her heart to keep him on a straight and narrow path. He's a kid who's so at risk of falling into the school-to-prison pipeline. He was abused in state care as well as, you know, with his own parents. He's a really good kid, and he's talented and smart, and, you know, there was hope for him, and there still is hope for him, but he can't seem to stay away from drugs and alcohol, and in the end, it's his undoing. So, and Quetzon, he's a classic case of that, and then Taos, whom Abby can talk about, up at Yurok, also grew up, well, he grew up in a home where there was alcohol, and he was taken away. It's just the same story over and over. And he is trying his hardest in the film. He was facing a third strike conviction when we first started filming, and he already had a little, very little child. And now he's trying to learn how to parent and become a good parent so that that intergenerational trauma doesn't come down to his little boy. So I think in the film it's really front and center, but to me what's hopeful about the film is how hard both the judges are working and House and others that, whose cases we followed are working to try to break that cycle.
I think the point is, you know, we, Claudette and I, we both live in the middle of that problem. We are part of that problem. And we are both, I think, very committed to holding out our hand to as many people as possible and having them hold out their hands. You know, one of the reasons that this problem became so pervasive is because we are so close as people to each other, so that bad spreads rapidly. But I also believe that good can spread also through the same thing, because that's our nature. So if we can get back to our nature, because we will share, and that caused us tremendous problems because we shared things that were bad. And now if we can share what's good and share our strength, I think we can try to pull ourselves out. And each one that gets out, I think then you see them become committed to helping others get out. My approach, as it, I think, is very similar to Claudette's. It's just don't give up. You keep trying, because they, you know, we belong in this place and they belong with us if they can be there. And so we work as hard as we can to try to do that, because it isn't like anybody's untouched by it. There's no family, there's no human that we're dealing with who has not had to deal with that.
One of the most moving things that I was privileged to be, you know, to film, to be at the filming of, was the graduation from the Yurok Wellness Court, which is one of the things that ends the film, where hundreds of people, family members and those who have been through Abby's Wellness Court, which deals with healing people affected by substance abuse. It's so joyous and so celebratory, because it's celebrating people graduating from the program, people who have gone through at least a year of Wellness Court and have stayed clean and sober, and their families are all around them celebrating. It's such a great community feeling there. And I don't see the film as a downer. I see it as a celebration of the hard work that these judges are doing and the hard work that the people who come before them are doing to break out of this cycle and lead successful lives. So that scene is just playing in my head right now. And, you know, they're just beautiful shots of this guy covered with tattoos carrying his little tiny baby girl in his arms, and Abby and her staff serving a meal to hundreds of Yurok tribal members. And I think there's a really positive feeling about what's happening and the way the film portrays it.
We heard most recently from Anne Makepeace, who is the writer, director, and producer of Tribal Justice. And also with us is Judge Abby Abananti, who is the chief Yurok tribal judge, and she is one of the two judges featured in Tribal Justice. Judge Abby, Anne was referring to the tribal wellness program. I found the sequence of the bureaucrats on the state side interacting, trying to mesh with the tribal system. It wasn't a huge part of the film, but I thought it was very interesting. One of them, who was a Superior Court judge, William Follett, I think it was he who said, "Interesting process, no rules in place. We work out the rules as we go forward because they're not written down anywhere." And for someone in the state system, that's very bewildering, I think. Would you please talk about the Yurok Wellness Program and how it works, and just take it from there, please?
Well, I think he's the kind of judge that we want to work with because he's very committed to it works, let's do it, you know. And he saw some of our people growing up. He sentenced them, you know, first to probation, then to YA, then to prison. And it's very frustrating as a judge to see nothing work because you go to work every day thinking, you know, I'm going to do something here. I'm going to help. And in this state, we have concurrent jurisdiction. And for the most part, everybody has interpreted that as being, okay, either you do it or we do it. And we've been able there to go, no, let's do it together. What's gonna make this turn around? How are we going to make this work? How are we going to keep this man out of going to jail for the rest of his life? Because if that's what we achieve, that's not really good enough for us. And that's essentially what he's saying. You know, and even if there's not a way in the book that says this is how you do it now, I'm willing to take a run at it. If it works, we're gonna do it. You know, and that's the kind of partner you really want to work with. I give him a lot of credit for that because he could have said, no, we're not doing this. I don't know what you're doing or why you're doing or whatever. But he's no, like, let's try this because you're having some success and I want this man to not go to prison for the rest of his life. That kind of commitment, that kind of partnership is what I'm really looking to build. And I think that's what Claudette is looking to build. And you see her meeting with various people outside the state people. The justice system has to come together. It's not like we want to go, okay, we're going to do this. No, what we're saying is, let's get this done. You know, nobody's best interests are served by stocking our prisons with our young people.
Please talk about the Yurok Wellness Program. What someone such as Taos Proctor, who's featured in the film, how it works?
Well, essentially, we're all in the same community. And we're much more relentless. I think, you know, that the others, the non-Yurok system has rules and regulations and check-in points. You know, if we sense something's going wrong, I will go to his house. Someone else will go to his house. We'll talk to him. We're very involved. And if we hear of anything not going well or if things are going well, we'll go out and talk to people. So we're much more involved in the day-to-day lives of the people who appear in front of us. And we can offer them support. And we can ask them and remind them of what their responsibilities are. Because Yurok lifestyle really is one of tremendous amounts of responsibilities to self and others. And if you're not meeting those, that's a problem. So it's really reminding them to do that. And you can see Taos being reminded, and you can see him doing more and more and more, you know, to fulfill those. Because you get away from that and you forget, you know, and you forget, oh, wait, if I don't do this, it's not going to get done. And that's a gap.
Making this film is how involved both Abby and Claudette were with people. I mean, they just don't give up. They're just fighting for their tribal members to solve their problems and to lead good lives. And that just can't happen in the state courts where judges can't know the people who come before them. I mean, I think there are many things about the tribal courts that can serve as models for state courts, concepts of restorative justice and dispute resolution and as opposed to just punishing people, all that. But what, again, as I say, struck me over and over was Abby said one time, you know, we just never give up, never give up, never give up. And that's personal. That means checking, as Abby just said, checking on people. Abby goes out at night a lot with her probation officer looking for people's warrants in the state system and convincing them to turn themselves in so they don't get in more trouble. It's a community thing as opposed to a judge up on a bench, you know, with a gavel.
Taos evolves in this film in a really beautiful way. And at one point, he's reporting to Judge Abbey, and it's not Judge Abbey is up on some bench and he's down below and all that. It's they're at a table talking together, and she's asking him questions, and he's very proud of himself. He says that he's secretary of rehab. He's soon to be the president. He started a father program to help elders clean their yards and things like that. He says it's the first time he's been clean and the first chance to look at himself and not just blame others. It was really beautiful to watch his evolution throughout the film. I do have a question, and maybe there isn't an answer to it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It's pointed out in the film that Native Americans have the highest methamphetamine use of any ethnic group in the United States and extremely high crime and incarceration rates. Do you have any sense of why meth?
It was readily available. It's inexpensive to make. It was easy to distribute, and that combination became very deadly, and you have a community like ours where we, as I mentioned earlier, share everything. And so it just spread like wildfire. Anything like that does. You know, you can look at different drugs that have come into the reservation. It's the same pattern. It starts here, then it goes, you know, everybody has 27 cousins. There it goes.
Yeah, and I think it's tied to, I mean, meth is huge in poor areas, native and non-native, all across the country. And I think because of the loss of the land base, and in the case of Yurok, you know, subsistence fishing has been severely reduced by dams and other environmental things. There's not a lot of employment. There is a lot of poverty. And I think it's in poor communities, as I say, across the country, where meth is prevalent. And unfortunately, Native American communities tend to be poor, and that's probably part of the reason for that statistic.
This isn't part of the film, but I'm curious. Judge Abbey, your land is along the Klamath River, is that correct?
Correct.
And was it the Klamath that, oh gosh, years ago now, the water was diverted upstream so that European American farmers got priority, and there was this tremendous salmon die-off. Did that affect your tribe?
Yes, that happened on the Klamath, on the lower part of the Klamath, the fish kill in the 90s.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, we reported on that back then, too. I feel like we're kind of not giving the Ketchan people their due. One of the cases that is highlighted was the case of, when the film starts, 9-year-old Drew Dennard. He had autism and epilepsy. And Anne, why don't you talk about that situation?
Yeah, I had actually wanted to follow a case from beginning to end of a child being taken away and then being brought back to the tribe through the Indian Child Welfare Act case. Drew Dennard's case is not really the classic case. The classic case is more like Isaac's, where, you know, he was taken away because of dysfunction in his family, and unfortunately he was not brought back as a young boy to the tribe. But Drew's situation was that because of his disabilities, his autism and his epilepsy, and I know he was really, really hard to take care of, and his mother tried really hard, and his parents aren't together, but they both participate in parenting, but she just couldn't handle him, and asked first tribal social services, you know, what she could do, and because there weren't services on the reservation, they referred her to El Centro, which is the county seat, about an hour from the reservation. And so she initiated contact with the state to try to get help for her son. And the state, as you've learned in the film, Child Protective Services recommended that they send Drew, they put him into a boarding school to try to diagnose and address his problems. Well, the boarding school at first was in El Centro, which wasn't so hard for Elaine, his mother, to get to. But within a month or so, the boarding school was moved to 4 hours away. And the arrangement that Elaine had agreed to was that Drew would be in the school for 6 months while he was being diagnosed and, you know, medication was being adjusted so that he could come home, and then he would be returned after 6 months. Well, 6 months went by, and 8 months and 9 months and 10 months, and the state refused to return him. So at that point, Elaine went to Judge Claudette White and asked that she invoke the Indian Child Welfare Act to see if they could bring him back to his family that way. And that's the story that's followed in the film. So while it's an unusual case because the mother initiated contact with the state, what follows is Claudette requests a transfer of Drew's case from state court to tribal court, and that entails a lot of bureaucratic stuff, but eventually, I don't know if I want to do a spoiler alert, but eventually she does get the case transferred back to tribal court. But it's a really difficult and long process, and one that, you know, really wore out Elaine, driving back and forth, you know, 4 hours to see her son, and going to state court in El Centro over.
Abby, why don't you take it from here until we get Anne back?
Okay. For us, I know we're working very hard, and I think Claudette is too, to team up. Let's have a team approach. Let's try to get this done together. We should have the same goals. And yes, we've had our quarrels over the years, and yes, you know, some of the animosity that I faced when I first came into the system is alive and well in some of these systems. But you know what? It's time to put it behind us. And that's what I really work hard to do. And I think that has to be the goal.
In the case of the Ketchan, we see footage often through the movie of their dancing. But there's also singing that's important. But Judge Abby, you mentioned that up in the Yurok, they have dance houses. Is that what it's called?
We certainly have very extensive dance responsibilities and cultural responsibilities. And those, we're not able to film those. We don't really do that. Our part of what our culture is, where we are at this particular point, is we don't really film it. So although Anne was invited as a guest, and she did go to a dance, it wasn't something that we felt comfortable filming. But we do have people who are involved with us go to dance camp, participate in dance camp, have their workers with them in camp, learn to sing, those different kinds of things. So it's a big part of what we do also.
We were talking about how Elaine, down at the Ketchan tribal system, was more and more frantic in trying to get her son back. It plays into what I think is one of the prejudices against Native American is the belief that they are more prone to violence than European Americans. And in fact, Drew did have some issues around violence. And that was one of the reasons that the state was not willing to let him back. Is that your, am I correct in that impression, Anne?
I don't think he was dangerously violent, but he would have tantrums and he would throw things. And he was reported by his teachers to be a danger to others. But it didn't take that long for them to figure out his medications in the state care system. Elaine said he did get better there in the school, but even when he was better and he was stable on meds and was not having tantrums and was not doing anything violent, it just took forever for her to be able to get him back. So
yeah,
I don't think that statistic is true. Native Americans are more violent than anybody
else.
No,
it's a prejudice. It's a bias.
Yeah, yeah.
Abby, do you want to add to that for maybe at the most 60 seconds?
Well, I guess what I was going to say is that when children, any child has a condition, it has to be treated. That's all he had. he was not a violent person. He was a child that had a condition.
Right.
And that's what it needs to be looked at. And anything else is inappropriate.
Very good. We thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio, both writer, director, producer Anne Makepeace, and Judge Abby Abenanti, Chief Yurok Tribal Judge. Thank you both very much for joining us today on Forthright Radio.
Thank you, Joy. Take care. And Abby, good to talk to you.
All right, bye-bye.
Our guests today on Forthright Radio have been Chief Yurok Tribal Judge Abby Abenanti, who is one of the two judges featured in Tribal Justice, and the writer, director, and producer of Tribal Justice, Anne Makepeace. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast usually each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LeClaire. You can contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com. And I'm pleased to announce that Forthright Radio now has a website, forthrightradio.wordpress.com. It's a work in progress, but check it out. And on it, you will find the show we did last October 2016 with UCLA history professor Benjamin Madley about his very important book, An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe.